In our Wednesday night class, we were talking about opportunities. There's that verse in Ephesians chapter 5, when Mitch was teaching that class, where it talks about making the most of your time. And of course, that can, I suppose, mean a lot of things to us. I mean, we all realize one of the things that we all do share in common is we got time. Most of us think we have less than others to do things that maybe we believe we ought to do. But nevertheless, we have it in common. And of course, the big question is how we use it. How do we use our time? How do we make the most of our opportunities? I was reminded of Esther when this discussion ensued on Wednesday evening. And of course, there's generally a reason why Esther gets raised. Sometimes it's because she's a woman. She gets discussed in women's classes. But when we study about her, a lot of times what we study about is the whole idea of God working in the life of someone, the providence of God. And both of those are very legitimate studies. But it's also about a person who finally got around to seeing the value in herself in terms of who she was and what she could do and what she could offer in life. So we want to talk about her this morning with the idea of sort of looking at ourselves, obviously, and seeing how we can really come up to our opportunities and realizing that, you know, there's a way these things work on us. We have to realize that when we do have an opportunity, it's very easy to put that off. And we also realize, many of us who've faced many opportunities to do right, to do good, that we easily forget the ones that we've passed up. And so maybe our conscience, because of that, we don't get as bothered about it. Because unless we have some sort of specific reminder about certain circumstances, we're quite happily sort of moving along, looking forward to our next opportunity. And maybe with the idea, this time I'm gonna really do what God wants me to do. One of the things that I think is important is noted in this poem by a guy named Edward Hale. And that you and I have to realize that we as individuals are important. A well-known denominational preacher who's preached in a lot of what you call sort of international or countrywide campaigns or community-wide campaigns has said, you know, for the most part, you don't really see anything like that in the Bible. For the most part, it's just individual people who are facing up to life and deciding what they were going to do about it. And so, again, occasionally we'll hear people saying we need to do something big. And the point is that I suppose you can do things that are big, but that's not generally what life is. That's not the day-to-day existence that you have. And so, granted, if I'm part of something big, it may make me feel a little bit more important as I'm connected to other people, but I must realize that I am important. And what I do as an individual is absolutely key. And Hale, I think, hits on this. He says, I'm only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do something that I can do. When you start thinking about opportunities as they come, we get a little bit overwhelmed, and we often have the same sentiment that he has. I can't do everything. But I can do something, though, ought to be the very next thing that comes into our head. And so as far as these specific opportunities that come along in life, I'm probably not going to take advantage of those. I'm not going to make the most of the time, as it says there in Ephesians, the fifth chapter, unless I see that what I do is important. And that doesn't mean you have to have some sort of grand ego to be a Christian. It just means that you are a very unique person facing very unique circumstances, unique only to you in your individual life. And you're the one who faces these opportunities that come in life. This guy, John Salisbury, and I've used this quote before in emphasizing the importance of oneness, had a list of a bunch of things that were one, depending on how you look at them, but they were decided by one vote. In 1776, one vote gave America the English language instead of German. In 1845, one vote brought Texas into the Union. In 1868, one vote saved President Andrew Johnson. Jackson was not impeached or near impeachment. One vote saved President Andrew Johnson from impeachment. And finally, in 1923, one vote gave Adolf Hitler control of the Nazi Party. So I think when we're thinking about votes, generally speaking, we tend to think that our votes are, you know, rather insignificant. And I suppose when we look at national elections, because we live in California, because we are generally the latest to close, and oftentimes the election is already decided, we are inclined to think our vote really doesn't matter. But doing what you can do, you can't change the world, you can't change California, but you can take on what is your life. And I think that's the emphasis here. So we could talk all we want about opportunities and making the most of our time, but we have to realize that we are, as individuals, we're very important to this, to seeing things happen. And the Bible is just replete with examples of that, of people who must realize, I am important in this place. I may not be that important to the greater scheme of things, but I am important in my own world. There's a lot of passages that speak to the idea that God's always looking for somebody who's willing to stand up. 2 Chronicles 16:9. The prophet was trying to help people to understand, and particularly a king, that there's not much going on around you and those in your kingdom. In 2 Chronicles 16:9, he says, the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. You have acted foolishly in this. Indeed, from now on, you will surely have wars. Then Asa was angry with the seer and put him in prison, for he was enraged at him for this. And Asa oppressed some of the people at the same time. This was spoken right to a king who really had plenty of opportunities to better the country, but he wasn't doing it. And the seer says, or the prophet says, that here's what's been going on. God's been looking for somebody who'd stand up for right. You're the king and you're not doing it. And it made him mad. And sometimes it makes a lot of us mad when we stand up here and talk about what we ought to be doing and how we can do more and things like that. Sometimes we may not outwardly show it, like in the case of the king. Maybe the king can get away with it better than we can. But we find it somewhat irritating, I think, at times. In Isaiah 59 and verse 15, he says, yes, truth is lacking, talking about the general atmosphere of the country. Well, why? He who turns aside from evil makes himself a prey. Now, the Lord saw, and it was displeasing in his sight, that there was no justice. And he saw that there was no man, and was astonished that there was no one to intercede. Then his own arm brought salvation to him, and his righteousness upheld him. I mean, it does get that bad, I suppose. This is the way it's being described. I mean, God is always looking for someone in, again, his or her unique circumstances, who's willing to stand for what is right and for what is true. And amazingly, there are times when there are not any people who are doing it. And that's a little hard for us to believe, because that's one of the problems that we have with opportunities and this whole idea of recognizing that we are one and we can do something, is that we're of the belief that even if we don't do something, there's got to be somebody out there who's doing it. And so again, that takes the pressure off me in terms of how do I face these circumstances intimate and unique to me and do what I can with them. Jeremiah 5 and verse 1. Roam to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem. And look now and take note and seek in her open squares if you can find a man. If there is one who does justice, who seeks truth, then I will pardon her. Kind of a similar situation to Abraham and to Lot and his circumstances in Sodom. But do we get the point here? That God understands how important you and I are as individuals. And far be it from us to really take that in a very serious kind of way. Again, because our belief is someone's doing it. Someone surely must be better at speaking, have more enthusiasm, more self-confidence, whatever it may be. We know exactly, I think, what I'm talking about. But there are just times when there's not anyone out there. Now, again, I can't speak to the whole world. Now, God knows in this particular circumstance, you know, just the bad state of the nation. But I can't even speak to your life. You know, though, you know about the opportunities that you have. And I want to say again, you are important because you are the one living in your circumstances. I am not, nor is anyone else. Brings us to Esther now and what I call her opportunity. The story starts out in the first chapter that the king was getting a little bit carried away with his own popularity and he wanted his wife to perform for him, I guess as a way of showing what a great guy he was. And she just really didn't want to participate in this spectacle. And so she's relieved of her responsibility of being queen. Well, they had to find a queen to take her place. And so they start searching throughout the kingdom to find someone to take her place. And it's quite a well-drawn-out plan that they use to try to find this one special woman. And granted, I mean, to a great extent, what this is going to have a lot to do with is how do you look? I mean, at this particular point, the only thing that is really something that is valuable for her is just how she looks. Now, she certainly becomes a whole lot more than that, but she was able to use that. She was able to use her good looks. Because eventually, because of her good looks, she gets picked to be the queen. Now, while this is going on, this rather significant leader, Haman, or Haman, depending on how you pronounce it, is being vexed by a guy named Mordecai, who refuses to bow down to him. He was an important person in the government, and Mordecai says, I'm just not doing this. I mean, obviously, he was doing that because he was only going to bow down to God. We see the same thing with Daniel. You know, he's presented with that set of circumstances. What do? These people want me to bow down and worship someone and give them respect and homage that they don't deserve. I refuse to do that. I'll take the consequences. And that's, I guess, what Mordecai was willing to accept. Well, just so happens that this woman, young woman Esther, who got picked to be queen, Mordecai was her cousin. And somewhat older than she was, because we get the impression from the text that he was given the responsibility of raising her. But she was part of his family. It says, Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, this is after he got so irritated with what Mordecai was doing, that Mordecai just would not succumb to the pressure to act like he was really important. So as rather, I don't want to say insane people, but people who are obsessed with their own greatness, he has a real simple solution. Maybe he could get away with killing Haman, killing Mordecai, but that's not going to be good enough for him. Or maybe he's thinking he could kind of hide the whole thing. He'll just start talking about the Jews, which, of course, of which Mordecai was a part of that nation, that they're all bad, and that's what that he does, and then he can get rid of Mordecai, who's the one who's really causing him the problem. And so he approaches the king. He says, there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all of those of other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. So that's it. Seems pretty simple. These guys are a problem. At least they were a problem to Haman. And certainly I think they're eccentric behavior compared to the other people who were involved in the nation, some of the others who'd been taken captive and brought there, of which they were a part. They even stood out amongst them. Now, I'm not too sure how much King Ahasuerus paid attention to what was going on around him. He seems rather disconnected to me in this whole operation, and Haman's the one who seems to be throwing this weight around. But eventually, here's what happens, verse 13. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children. In one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. So that's going to be it. The edict, the written decree, goes out. People are becoming very, very aware of what's going on. The Jews, on a given day, the day was appointed, and they're going to be destroyed. But you can see that as far as the people who are involved in this, they're not as interested in this. I mean, maybe they don't understand it completely, these couriers who are taking these edicts all around. It says they went out impelled by the king's command while the decree was issued at the citadel in Susa, the capital. And while the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion. Now, nobody knows exactly what that means, to say the city was in confusion. But I don't know why you would mention it unless to say there are a lot of people wondering what this was all about. Because by all information that we have, that they were pretty assimilated into the culture rather than their, or other than the fact that they had these interesting to the people religious beliefs about one God and things that certainly did separate them. But there was confusion about it. So I get the sense that not everybody thought this was such a great idea. Okay, so here's this young woman who becomes queen and probably enjoying a lot of the perks of royalty, and probably not expecting what was about to happen, because she finds out what is being planned. And guess what? Nobody knows that she's Jewish. Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai, that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. She was seemingly, at this point, not really seeing the big picture. And she's going to become more aware of that. But one of the things, again, understand my point, is that she is going to see just how important she is in this. Up to this point, she's just kind of a pretty face. And then, because she's a pretty face, then there are going to be people who are going to say, well, she's just lucky, and so you hear that enough times that you start thinking you're not very important. But things are going to be changing. It says, Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs. This was the guy who had been taking care of her as the new queen, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. So she gets the idea of what's going on, and she knows about how Mordecai is just in the public arena out there mourning, and she's maybe thinking he better stop doing this, because given what they're deciding, he's calling more attention to himself, maybe not realizing completely these circumstances between Mordecai and Haman. So here's what Hathach gets from Mordecai. It says, Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her, and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for his people. Now this is where it starts getting touchy. Up to this point, she's feeling really lousy about what's going on. Up to this point, she's very, very concerned about this man who raised her. But at this point, she's in the what I call sort of the thinking stage or the discussion stage. And this is where we stay, I think, all too often. A lot of times we kind of find ourselves constantly in the thinking stage. You know, we all know what we're going to do. We're thinking about it. We're musing. We're meditating. Whatever it is we're doing, we got things that we're thinking about we're going to do. But you see, going from that to the actual doing of something is a very different thing. And maybe she doesn't completely understand this. However, she's been told she needs to be told to go to the king and get this stopped. How did she first react? Probably like you would react or like I would react. She spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. And so here's what it is. She's thinking about it. She's given it very, very serious thought. She knows, she doesn't say this is a bad idea. Now, again, I want you to try to put your own life into this particular little scenario and understand how this generally works. Most of us are always thinking about opportunities to do things, looking for opportunities. We understand it's a good thing. It's something we could discuss in Bible class in terms of this is a significant thing. I know I should do good, and I need to be looking for opportunities to do good. But when it actually happens, then it becomes a little bit different, because now you're going to get squeezed a little bit, and that's what happens to her. So here's the reaction. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, is not summoned, he has but one law, and that is to be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter that he may live. And I have not been summoned to the king or to come to the king for 30 days. Okay. She's not denying that this is a good idea. But she's saying, do you realize what you're asking me to do? I mean, I'm being faced. I just got into this situation, and I was looking really great, and they kind of handpicked me out. They took care of me, fixed me all up, and now here I am, and now what am I going to have to do? Do you realize what this is like to go in and visit the king? Understand, you know, that this isn't Camelot, you know, where you get these kind of more typical, traditional marriage relationships and how they work. This is not what you would normally expect. I mean, here she is, the queen, but she's really just more one of a harem, but she's, you know, right there at the top of the ladder. But she says, you know, you just don't go in and talk to this guy without realizing that unless you happen to catch him in a good mood, or he really, really seems to think you're making sense, and he says, okay, I give you the golden scepter, boy, you're done, you're toast. Now, again, give this serious consideration. To her, this makes perfect sense. Now, I don't know what brought her to this point where she finally said, I'd really like to do this, but this just isn't really my cup of tea. And I want you and I to be thinking about that, because this process is very typical amongst all of us. We have this vision of the way our lives are supposed to be as Christians. We understand what they are, and then sometimes we just give it up, and we feel that we're not worthy, and all kinds of things that seem to inhibit us from, you know, making whatever change we need to make. Well, she's probably thinking that everybody's going to understand when she offers this. But okay, here's Mordecai's, and she's probably really very fortunate that she had this individual who would see her as a real person and not as royalty. Mordecai told them to go back and tell Esther, do not imagine that you are in the king's palace and can escape any more than all the Jews. Reality check, he's going to find out who you are, and it may be embarrassing, but you know, they replaced that other queen pretty easily. They can replace you. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. So some of us may end up better, but the fact that you have been out front with your Jewishness is going to make you an easy target. And the rest of us may end up okay in this deal, but you're probably going to get killed. And then he makes this very, very significant statement. It's the ultimate providential, the ultimate opportunity statement. Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? And that's the spiritual slap in the face, isn't it? You're trying to diminish your own importance, my young cousin. But right now, the reality is really, for you and ultimately for the rest of us, you are the person. You are the one. You are important. So as I look out there and I see your faces, and I know that some of us are more involved than others in the Lord's work, but I think there is a belief by many that even though maybe I'm not taking my opportunities and doing something with them, that I think we've got some good people here doing it. And that's true. But see, they don't have your circumstances. I don't have your circumstances. You don't have my circumstances. I have very unique opportunities, as do you, to say, I'm going to take a stand. And that's what young Esther is really confronting here. And her cousin, slash probably more like an uncle, is saying, you are one and you mean something. And what are you going to do? Have you ever stopped to think that all of this stuff that happened up to this point was not God's working to put you in this place? And boy, isn't that overwhelming? Have you ever thought about that when you confront an opportunity to do good, trying to decide what you're going to do? And then if I look at it like this, and I think all these circumstances in my life that all these years may have had something to do to leading up to this particular point in my life, to where I'm going to determine whether that's why I'm here. I mean, really, when you think about it, it must have been kind of exciting for her, you know, to hear, even though this is kind of a blow when she finds out what she's really got to do, and she is important. But, you know, to find out that she really does matter, when it's just so easy to dismiss ourselves as not being very important at all. And I'm trying to figure out a right way to say this. Again, to emphasize that each of us are important, not because we have greater skills or ability. Again, it's because of our unique circumstances. That's what makes one important. And I hope I'm conveying that well to us. Because I know, you know, we've got all the parts of the body. 1 Corinthians 12, Romans. And yeah, some people seem to be more significant than others, but that doesn't make you unimportant. Because one is important. How do you know that the things that are happening to you right now, leading up to this point, have not brought you to the place where you can really demonstrate who you are? And that's what Esther has to do. So what are you going to do when you're confronted with that? She presented a pretty good argument. You guys know this is kind of a tough job here doing this, and I could lose my life. I mean, would he listen to me? Maybe. There's that one chance that he might. It does happen occasionally. That's that golden scepter thing. But here's what happens. It says, Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. And do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I mean, do you realize the step of commitment, you know, that she's just taken? All right. I want people to know I'm serious about this deal. Get the word out there. I want people to be praying for me and fasting for me. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go to the king, which is not according to the law. I mean, I just kind of like she's wanting to remind people that, you know, this may not work because I'm really not supposed to be doing this to begin with. But here's the way I look at it. If I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. Now there's a lot that happens between chapter 4 and on through up to chapter 7. How she actually pulled the thing off. And I mean, she really shows that she's not just a pretty face. I mean, she's very shrewd the way she created this whole opportunity to flip the tables on Haman, and Haman ends up being the one who gets killed. So, yeah, she may have gotten where she was through the visuals, but boy, she showed herself to be very, very shrewd in what she did. But she made the decision. And this, I think, is where I struggle, and I think probably most of us here struggle. We think about it, we talk about it, we know we should, all that. But it's taken to that next step. It's where you decide to announce to the group, you guys, I'm going to do something, and I really like your support, and I'd really like for you to pray for me. And I don't know what's going to happen, good or bad. Maybe I don't know what's going to, how people are going to receive me, or one person's going to receive me. I don't know how that's going to work, but I'm in. See, she made the decision to jump, and I think that's probably where we don't find ourselves often enough. Again, we're in the theoretical stages. We're real, real good in the theoretical. I'm just about as good as anybody. It's the decision to jump that where I decide I am important. Not because I'm a talented human being. I am important because I am who I am, and the people with whom I have contact are unique to me. And that's true of everyone who's here. There's another example of David. For chapter 17, he has already been anointed king. I mean, that was the big kind of thing that went on between David's family and Samuel comes along, and I don't think a lot of people know very much about it, but his family sure knew about the fact that God had decided Saul's no good, he's got to go, he's a disobedient king, and we need another king. And David, who's the young guy in the family, who doesn't look very, very kingly, looks exactly like who he was. He was a shepherd. But he's about to get his opportunity. What he finds out about is that this Goliath, this Philistine, is just taunting the soldiers of Israel and coming out and saying, look at me, I'm a big giant. Is anybody here prepared to take me on? And people are just withering, and they just are terrified, and nobody wants to face him. And David becomes aware of this. Now, he could have maybe formulated, you know, some sort of a committee to discuss it. But David is starting to see this like Esther eventually saw it. And that is, something's happening here. And if other people are unprepared to do it, I'm not the one who really is likely to be the one who ought to be doing this. I'm not a soldier. My family has got soldiers in it, and they're already out there fighting. It would be much more logical for it to be someone else. And so, you know, the Bible's full of that stuff, isn't it? You know, we were talking about various tests of loyalty that we had. That's just the way everybody was. Almost everybody said, no, not me. This isn't for me. This is for somebody else. And David really, I think, was probably looking pretty much the same way, but more and more it's starting to look like to David, like it was to Esther, I am who I am. I have this set of circumstances which is demanding sort of some sort of response from me. And I know what it seems to me ought to be happening, but nobody else is doing it. So he goes down to engage those who are in the battle. He spends some time occasionally going back and forth with his brothers, helping them out. And probably he's a little bit like, he's got the Joseph complex. I mean, already his brothers don't like him very much. I suspect that the whole ordeal of his being anointed king over all of them didn't help. And so you get very clearly what their attitude is toward him. He says to them, well, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine, takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? Now, again, when we decide, we're certainly inkling that something needs to be done, and maybe I'm thinking about doing it. And here's where most of us run into the problems. This is where we want people around us to encourage us. And we talked about this. I can't remember the example, but I think it was Joseph, since I brought him up earlier, that, you know, when it was time for him to decide, there was nobody around him to encourage him to do what was good, in the way he knew what it meant. So Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and his anger burned against David and said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle. Aha! You know, here's one of these guys, you know, who has all the insight that nobody else has. Too many people like that in the world. They do nothing for the unity of a congregation. They do nothing for the people around them at their job. They're just the smartest person there who understands everything. I know why you're here, and it's not good. I know your motives, and they're not good. This is the same guy, by the way, who God says he was a man after my own heart. But not to Eliab, his brother. So here's David's response. Probably like any little brother would. What have I done now? Was it not just a question? And I think he probably was smart enough to know to these guys it was going to be read in a very different way, because there seems to already have been tension between them. So then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing as before. Meaning, how much can a guy make to do this? And the word is out there, and the information is there, and what Eliab is telling him, very much the same thing. Now, he's at that thinking phase. He's at this point now where he's thinking like you and I. You know, I really know how I've been doing these things up to this point, but I'm not going to do it this way anymore. I'm really thinking this is something I need to do. Making the most of my time. Here comes my opportunity. So he thinks that at the very least, I mean, he understands he's going to be questioned by his brothers. So he decides, I'm going to go to the king and just let him know what I'm going to do. Find out what he's going to say. So when the words which David spoke were heard, they told him to Saul and sent for him. So David says to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Great, says Saul. We finally found someone with the courage to take the opportunity to do good. Again, if you're waiting for a cheering section, it just doesn't work that way in life. Because most of the time when you are confronted and I'm confronted with these various opportunities that come along, it's just you and the opportunity. So here's what Saul says. You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, even though, you know, while he has been a warrior from his youth. Or that's talking about Goliath there, although sometimes I used to think that maybe he was allowing for that understanding of David. All right, so he's got all the information, I guess, that he thinks he needs. He's not shocked that his brothers think what they think about him. Probably not real shocked about what the king says, because he knows he just doesn't look like the guy. You know, Moses, Elijah, Jeremiah, everybody, they never think they're the guy. Gideon, they never think they're the guy. So David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. I mean, so what's Saul going to say to that? I mean, at the very least, he's just going to lose this young guy who's, according to his brothers, or not really much of a shepherd anyway. You know, you need to go back to those few little sheep you take care of. So he wasn't the MVP for anybody. But he says, go and may the Lord be with you. And of course, we know what happened. We know what happened, don't we? He did exactly like Esther. He went through pretty much the same process as Esther. And just like I do, and just like you do, when it comes to trying to figure out where we fit in the world. Now, nobody came along to him and said, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Pretty poetic, you know, what Esther was able to hear from Mordecai. He doesn't get anything like that. To him, there was just enough evidence as to what this was about. I'm not the only guy who could do this, but if nobody else is going to do it, I am one. And my one means something. And I will make it, with God's help, mean something. And so he did it. And these are pretty big deals. I mean, you know, these are not the kind of things. I mean, the level of significance in the lives of these two individuals are nothing. Mine's nothing like that, nor is yours. But you are just as important to your circumstances as they were in terms of how they saw themselves. I am the one presented with this opportunity, and I am going to take it. I am going to make the most of my time because, as it says further, because the days are evil, because you just don't know how much time you have. The time is fast passing away. You can go ahead and look at, if you have the chance to look at the outline, there are three things of application that or three or four things there you can, I think, make on your own, and we're going to just leave it at that, because I think the lesson is pretty clear in terms of the application as far as the way I've tried to present it to you. And again, you know, what we're always trying to do is to stimulate from theory, from thinking, to, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be this person. Maybe it's just as simple as it's time to go up to that person that maybe I've had my differences with and smile and say hello and say, I care about you. Now, that's not killing Goliath, and it's certainly not saving a whole nation so that salvation can come through the Jews, but it's your thing. It's what you have the power over. And I dare say Esther couldn't fix your problem, nor could David. You are the unique one, and you mean something, and I mean something. And that's what Esther, I believe, and David teach us. Each one of us, whatever our circumstances, we mean something. Thank you so much for your wonderful attention this morning. It'll be the last time we see some of you for a while. We'll be back talking a little bit more about Esther this evening, but as most of you know, and Rick will be talking about it, but it's finally here. You know, we've been putting off this Philistine thing. Oh, geez. This Philippines thing. A little longer than usual. It just seems like it never was going to come around. And I've even had a few of you say, aren't you supposed to be gone? And it is about to happen. And we, of course, want you to pray for us. You mean so much to us. And you have a great role in that. And you are important. If you're not a child of God, you want to become a Christian today, your soul means something. Your one is important to God. And he desires all to be saved. And that opportunity is provided for you. Do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Are you willing to confess that he is the Christ, be baptized into Christ? You've studied that. You understand it. You're ready to act. Why don't you do that as we stand and sing? Robert?